Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Friday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. David French of National Review is in for Jim Garrity today. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives to wrap up the work week. And David, we start with good news that follows on yesterday's bad martini. Yesterday, Jim and I had some not-so-kind words for the Republicans putting tax legislation together because they not only took out the adoption tax credit in the original edition of the House bill, the Republicans voted in lockstep to block a Democratic amendment to put it back in. But the blowback from pro-life groups, from Christian organizations, from adoptive families, prospective adoptive families, the message finally got through. CNN story. Both the House and Senate agree the adoption tax credit is off the chopping block. Republican senators introduced their tax overhaul Thursday afternoon, and it preserved the adoption tax credit according to initial materials from the Senate Finance Committee. Last week, House Republicans introduced their 429-page tax overhaul that included repealing the credit, but Ways and Means Committee Chairman Kevin Brady offered an amendment Thursday that would preserve the credit. Adoption advocates breathed a sigh of relief at the change. The argument for taking it out, at least as the opposition started to build here, David, was that, well, it's only advantaging rich families because of the tax code when they adopt. Middle class and lower class people, when they adopt, it's not advantaging them, so we'll just get rid of it altogether instead of amending the law to actually have it benefit everybody who's trying to do a wonderful thing and adopt a child here. So you not only wrote about this yesterday, you're an adoptive parent, and for the millions of families that have done this, this is very good news.
Yeah, it's great news. And one thing that I want to deal with is this notion that the adoption tax credit only benefits wealthy families. Well, number one, for the truly high income families, it doesn't benefit them at all because it phases out. So if you're over once you're over $200,000 of income, it starts to phase out, and it phases out pretty quickly once you're over $200,000 in income. And the other thing is, here's why the credit tends to benefit upper middle class families, because adoption is so stinking expensive that only upper middle class families, as a general rule, can afford it. So you're talking about, I mean, how many people can in 1 year absorb $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 in additional payments and additional expenses out of their household budget? I mean, think about that. I mean, there's not many upper middle class families that can do that. And the adoption tax credit was vital. I mean, there were many families that adopted with us in our adoption group who talked openly about how critical that adoption tax credit was to being able to adopt their kids. So this was incredibly important to add back. It was such a small budgetary item anyway. I mean, the quote unquote tax expenditure of it, a term I hate for being permitted to keep more of your own money. But the tax expenditure was only about $300 million. So this was a very good news to see this added back. And I applaud the House Republicans for changing their mind.
Yeah, they finally did listen to the protests. Let's move on to the bad martini. David, another issue you have written about here in the last 24 hours, and one that is just ugly in every respect, and we're going to focus on what I think is the ugliest respect here. Yesterday, the Washington Post released a story written by three different people that told the allegations of four different women who, as teenagers in the 1970s, said that a then early 30s Roy Moore, who is now, of course, the Republican nominee for U.S. Senate in Alabama. That special election is next month. They claim that he struck up relationships with them, romantically intended. Three of them, between ages 16 and 18 at the time, say they amounted to kissing. Another one who was 14 at the time is the one that everybody's looking at here. Her name is Lee Korfman. She was 14 at the time in 1979, says that he struck up a relationship with her while he offered to watch her outside a court proceeding that her mother was involved in. He eventually got her phone number. Then he met up with her alone a couple different times. And the second time, allegedly at his house, he plied her with alcohol and then removed her clothes except for her undergarments and his underwear. And he touched her, took her hand to touch him. She says she resisted and he eventually took her home. Moore is adamantly denying these allegations in his public statements. David, obviously we're seeing a lot of people wondering about the timing of this with the election right around the corner. He's been a public figure for so long. Why hasn't this come out before? Of course, we are now in this culture of a lot of people coming forward about having been abused, whether it's Hollywood or anywhere else. The thing I want to focus on here, though, is the reaction specifically of Alabama Republicans, even if it is true. Let's take a look at some of this. The state auditor is a guy named Jim Ziegler. Nothing to see here, he says. The allegations are that a man in his early 30s dated teenage girls. Even the Washington Post report says that he never had sexual intercourse with any of the girls and never attempted sexual intercourse. Same guy. Also invoked the fact that Zechariah and Elizabeth in the Bible were perhaps of disparate ages, and also says, take Joseph and Mary. Mary was a teenager and Joseph was an adult carpenter. They became parents of Jesus. Alabama State Representative Ed Henry went further, questioning the timing of the allegations and suggesting that if true, the accuser should be prosecuted for not coming forward sooner. Quote, if they believe this man is predatory, they are guilty of allowing him to exist for 40 years, he told the Cullman Times. Quote, I think someone should prosecute and go after them. You can't be a victim 40 years later, in my opinion. And then there's Alabama Marion County Republican Chair David Hall, who says it was 40 years ago. I really don't see the relevance of it. He was 32. She was supposedly 14. She's not saying that anything happened other than they kissed. So, obviously, the reaction from most on Capitol Hill has been, if there's any shred of this that's true, Roy Moore needs to step aside. There's the politics angle of this, of course, with just a couple weeks or a few weeks left before this special election. But, David, the rationalization of it, even if it's true, means our politics are at a gutter level that perhaps we couldn't even envision a short time ago.
You know, I don't even know what to say about this. I'm literally at a loss. If you've got people who are saying electing a junior senator from Alabama is worth overlooking credible accusations of pedophilia, or worth electing him, even if they are true, that small of an office is worth it, even if it's true, and then going out of their way to distort biblical accounts. I mean, the whole point of the story of Mary and Joseph, that was a virgin birth.
Right.
I mean, this was not Joseph's son. I mean, this is unbelievable. I mean, what it tells me is there's some horrible people in Alabama politics. And not to pick on Alabama, but I have a distinct feeling that if Roy Moore was from Tennessee, you'd have people, you know, in my state crawling out of the woodwork. You should see my personal Facebook page, as people are crawling out of the woodwork to defend Moore. Look, we don't know if it's true. But there are three parts of this that really gave me pause. Number one, people say, well, why'd they come forward so late? If you read the Washington Post story, they didn't actually come forward. They were sought out by the Post. The Post found them. So this wasn't like some opposition. So far as we know, there's no indication that this was some opposition politician bringing out accusers. These were people who were tracked down by the Post. So that I think is very important. Number two, this was multiply sourced. So you had four women telling similar stories about similar conduct in the teenage years. And then you had multiple people aside from that saying, yeah, these girls told me about it at the time. So they didn't come forward. They were found. It was multiply sourced by people who claim that they were also told about it at the time. And then here's the other thing that really rings true. One of the women, the Lee Korfman, the one who was the principal victim, the worst conduct was towards her, said, well, one of the reasons why I didn't come forward is my life was a mess. And I thought I would just be, you know, humiliated and it would be horrible. And here's one of the things that happens in abuse situations time and again, especially when the abuser is a powerful man. The abuser continues to go on and prosper while the victim goes into a downward spiral. And so the gap of power between the victim and the abuser just grows and grows and grows. And here's another important thing to remember. When he was doing this, allegedly, he was the DA. He was, so who do you complain? He's law enforcement. So here you have these teenage girls and essentially one of the chief law enforcement officers is engaging in this conduct. I mean, where do they go? Where do they go? And so, you know, those are reasons why I'm really, really troubled. And then here's the other thing that gets me. And this really gets me. My Facebook feed is full of people I know defending Moore and giving him the benefit of the doubt and accusations, who have given zero benefit of the doubt and presume the accuracy of all of every allegation they ever read against a Democrat. And so, look, we just got – this isn't hard. This isn't hard. We just apply the same standards to both sides. If a Democrat – if there were multiply sourced credible allegations of this kind of behavior on the part of Roy Moore's opponent in Alabama, how would these people feel? How would these people react? That's a question, and I think we all know the answer to it. Just apply the same standards to both sides. The laws of morality apply equally to both sides. Why can't we apply the same standards? And this is what is one of the things that's so distressing about our political moment.
Our political moment is in a very distressing position, David. I would guess that their response would be that if a person on the left or a person in entertainment and was probably also on the left gets outed, it's because the left media has no other choice but to do that because the facts are there. They're going to argue that the media in this case has an agenda. I'm guessing that would be their response.
Well, sure. I mean, yeah, that's obviously the response. But, you know, the Bill Clinton allegations going all the way back to the 1990s, you know, Newsweek was going to correct me if I'm wrong on this chronology, but Drudge broke it because Drudge found out that one of the mainstream media outlets, Newsweek, was about to kill the story or might kill the story. And Drudge broke it. This was all the way the Monica Lewinsky story.
Right.
And then, you know, vigorously Clinton defended himself from the allegations, from every single allegation, vigorously. And this is when the left did not cover itself in glory. It rallied around Bill Clinton. And I grew up in a conservative movement that said, no, you don't rally around politicians who are facing multiple allegations of misconduct. You don't do that. Politics isn't worth it. You maintain your integrity. That's the conservative movement I grew up with. And now this new, whatever this kind of movement is, says, no. All that matters is winning elections. That's what really matters. So, you know, look, multiply sourced allegations of misconduct with teenage girls. Well, you know, it's more important to me that we win a special election for the junior senator of Alabama than really seriously consider that. That's not the conservative movement I grew up with.
David, fascinatingly, Matt Iglesias, who is no moderate or certainly not a conservative, he's a far left writer over at Vox, and he tweeted out, would our situation in politics, this is a paraphrase, be any different now if Democrats had insisted that Bill Clinton resign in 1998? Ultimately, I think the way that our culture and our politics have gone, we'd probably be pretty close to the same place. But what do you think? If Bill Clinton had not been defended as vigorously as you mentioned, would we be in a different spot right now?
Oh, I think we would.
Yeah?
I actually do think we would. I think that there's a lot of cascading consequences from that. So, you know, for one thing, you never would have had a Hillary Clinton nomination in all likelihood. The Clinton brand would have been disgraced earlier. How would the 2000 election have turned out? Who knows? there's a lot, you know, when you have something as consequential as the resignation of a president for misconduct. You know, one of the interesting things that happened after Nixon's resignation is that the American public, for a short time anyway, really swung hard towards trying to ensure character and integrity in their public officials. You know, one of the big appeals of Jimmy Carter, and he turned out to be an incompetent president, but one of the big appeals to Jimmy Carter was we would be following Richard Nixon with a Baptist Sunday school teacher, a very humble guy who was the opposite in so many ways of this Machiavellian Richard Nixon character. Now, it turned out that Jimmy Carter, unfortunately, was a super incompetent president. But, you know, if you actually have a stand in politics for moral integrity, there are ripple effects from that. There are positive ripple effects from that. And when you don't, when you abandon integrity, there are ripple effects from that as well. And I think that, you know, one, there are a couple of things that that did is it deeply embittered Republicans, particularly against the Clintons, against the left more broadly, and hardened an awful lot of hearts. It was a very serious cultural and political miscalculation over the long term, I think, for Democrats to rally around him to make sure that Bill Clinton and not Al Gore was president from 1998 to 2000.
All right, let's move on to our crazy martini now, David. And you were here last Friday, and just after we finished recording, we got the news flash that Bo Bergdahl, who pleaded guilty, mind you, of desertion and misbehavior before the enemy, would not get any jail time. And so we kind of had to get through the weekend, and then we had the church shooting. And so the story kind of got buried after that. We never really had a chance to discuss it much on this podcast. But now there's two more developments to this story. First of all, his lawyer believes that Bergdahl ought to get a POW medal. And now this move, courtesy of hotair.com, Andrew Malcolm's writing this. Now that Bo Bergdahl has pleaded guilty to desertion in combat, taxpayers may owe him several hundred thousand dollars in back pay and benefits. From the moment of his capture, June 30th, 2009, Bergdahl became eligible for extra captive pay, in addition to his sergeant's salary and various allowances for things such as deployment, housing, subsistence, and prisoner per diem. The Army Times did some calculations and came up with a possible payment in excess of $300,000. The exact amount payable would depend on his changing service status between various calendar dates. At first, he was classified whereabouts unknown, then missing dash captured. Since his return, Bergdahl has been assigned to desk duty with appropriate pay, but perhaps pleading guilty to desertion would change the captured status and pay. The actual calculations have been delayed during the legal proceedings and could be extended further if Bergdahl appeals the dishonorable discharge sentence, as his lawyer has indicated that he will. So, David, feel free to discuss any of the developments in the past week, given your time as a JAG officer in the United States Army. What do you make of the judge, and what do you make of this possibility, perhaps a good possibility, that taxpayers will be on the hook for hundreds of thousands of dollars in pay to Bo Bergdahl?
Well, you know, this is just the really sour icing on a pretty rotten cake. The problems here go back to the Obama administration, of course. I mean, you had this ridiculous prisoner exchange. So you already paid a huge price to the enemy to get him back. That was Obama incompetence. Then you had a festival of Trump incompetence as he continued to opine on the outcome of the case, even as commander in chief, which raises the specter of something called unlawful command influence, which is a no-no under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. And the judge indicated that he took it into account, you know, he would take it into account in, as a mitigating factor in Bergdahl's case. Then you have the judge, rather than just say, well, that was one mitigating factor, but he still gets at least some prison time, the judge gives him no prison time at all. So he's going to walk. And now he's going to get a nice bonus, probably a bonus bigger than bigger than 99% of Americans would ever see in their whole lives. It just boggles the mind. But hey, this is the most 2017 thing possible, because if anything, we've learned that however bad you think a news cycle can get, or however absurd a news story can get, there's always another layer. There's always something else. There's always more depths to plunge. And we're deep in the Marianas Trench of incompetence and stupidity and injustice in this case. And so, yeah, why not? Why not? Let's make it 600 grand while we're at it. I mean, come on.
David, I heard you groaning when I mentioned in passing that his lawyer thinks Bergdahl deserves the POW medal. Do you want to comment on that?
You almost feel like that's the lawyer trolling us. He's saying that that would be something he would be entitled to because of legal status, not because of good conduct. And that if he is adjudicated to have been a prisoner of war, then by right he would have that. But to even raise this as a possibility is just essentially taking salt in the wound, in a public wound, and just rubbing that salt in the public wound. It's so egregious. It just feels like trolling. I mean, you know, his story from the beginning has been ludicrous. I listened to the serial broadcast on NPR, the podcast on NPR, where he tells his story. And I have to tell you, as somebody who's been in combat outposts, somebody who's been deployed, his story just makes flat out no sense to me. Just makes no sense. I cannot fathom, cannot imagine walking out of one of our combat outposts or walking out of one of our bases at any moment during our deployment. Everyone knew what would happen if you were caught. Everybody knew what would happen. It's insanity. And yet there's no indication here that he was legally insane. So his story just flat out does not, it just does not check out. But here we are, no jail time. People were hurt searching for him. It disrupted the tempo of operations in an entire area of operations in Afghanistan. But hey, no jail, back pay. Why not?
Unbelievable. And you are right. 2017 has been a doozy, and we're not done yet, I have a feeling.
No, we're not. No, I thought when 2016 was over, maybe we would begin to get more rational news cycles. But as John Podoritz tweeted out the other day, it was like only a few days ago that a guy killed a bunch of people in the middle of Manhattan with his car. And that's like forgotten, you know, that there was a terror attack in the middle of Manhattan. And that feels like ages ago. That's how crazy the news cycle has been moving.
Completely forgotten for the most part, at least in the mainstream media. David, yep. Always great to have you with us. Have a fantastic weekend and we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
David French of National Review in for Jim Garrity today. Jim will be back on Monday. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Have a great weekend, everyone. And please tune in Monday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.